early days of radio, where it was a small number of transmitters covering large parts of continent of Africa or the world, ranges greatly reduced so that you now get community radio stations, which can get a low power FM type of radio in a small area, which allows you then to reuse that frequency many times over the country. And then a growing number of satellite applications, all in different frequencies. But then if you can focus the application, you can reuse that frequency. So the frequency can be used either in different parts of South Africa or in different parts, in different countries, with the qualification there that we run into fun trying to coordinate across borders.
I see a hand. Shall we take that hand quickly?
Thank you very much. Much appreciated, Ms. Abrams. Mr. Sutherland, as an Inverness boy, you don't know what cold is. So I can't see your presentation on my screen. I'm not sure if any other members are having the same problem, but I'm having a difficulty then following what you're saying. I wonder if anybody else could confirm. I've gone through my documentation. I haven't been sent your presentation yet, so I can't follow it sort of on the side. There we are. Got it. Thanks very much. Sorry about that, folks. Thank you.
Can everyone now see? Everyone happy? Thank you.
I'm not going to argue with Mr. McKenzie about different temperatures. I merely say they come from quite far north. So broadcasting was originally analog. Then we moved to digital, and digital becomes very important. There are transmitters. Some of those are terrestrial on the Earth, and some of those are satellite in space. And that itself causes a whole range of very complicated problems. Radio originally and then television. So the radio moves forward, amplitude modulation, long wave radio. For many years I worked in Brussels, and from Brussels I could listen on long wave radio to broadcast from the United Kingdom. So as you get to the higher frequencies, you get more localized radio. And the more localized radio allows you to then think in terms of communities, cities. And development. Then you move to digital audio broadcast. Not a great success. Digital radio has struggled, but it has the potential to carry many more signals. One of the catches that you have in here is you have a very large installed base of equipment, and that makes change quite difficult. Another, just as a side comment, most mobile phones have in them an FM radio. In order to use that, you then have to plug in the headset to get to use the cable in the headset for an antenna. But the thing that tells you is that you can now just hide the whole of a radio inside the electronics of a smartphone. It's got that sophisticated. Television broadcasts have changed frequencies. They were once upon a time in black and white, then they were in color. Many countries in the many developed economies put in cable distribution networks. Because it was difficult to reach, it was possible to offer much, much bigger ranges of choice, many more channels. So Comcast in the US would be a classic example. And those have moved into internet provision. And then you had satellite distribution, great for covering very large geographies, sophisticated satellites beaming down multi-choice, on digital media, things like the new Telstar 11N satellite. But you also had much greater definition. So you start off definition on television and gradually more and more and more. And that's a function of screen technology, which is improving, and it's a function of our capacity to transmit the signal. And we're moving to 8K is relatively affordable, and 16K coming along. So you have this mixture of terrestrial broadcast, satellite broadcast, increasing definition, more compression into the signal, and finding new frequencies to get to people. Digital broadcasting, I seem to remember the launch of digital broadcast in South Africa was in 2008. The minister launched it then. It's much more efficient than analog. It will carry more channels. You have more choice. You can put on a single frequency several channels. You get better quality, you get higher resolution, you get less interference. But the catch, economic catch, is it requires new studios, new outside broadcast units, new transmitters, new receivers. One of the people from SABC was complaining to me at the Football World Cup that it had been so much easier in Germany, which had hosted it the last time, because they had access to adjoining countries with the equipment, whereas South Africa could not draw on high-quality, digital, high-resolution broadcast, outside broadcast units from nearby countries to cover the matches. So you have to then make your transmitters digital, you have to make your receivers digital, and that takes us into what I know is the very contentious issue of set-top boxes. The set-top box converting the digital signal to the analog signal in order to allow people to listen or watch on existing equipment. The qualification in all of this is that it is being superseded. People switch to streaming audio and streaming video. You can pick when you watch. If you miss something that's being broadcast while we're on this session, you can go and do it in catch up at another time. You can binge watch the whole of the Crown or Game of Thrones or whatever at one go in that way. So it raises difficult economic questions about, do you invest in digital broadcasting if people are going to watch it in some other way? How do you combine the two? What makes sense? Another block of frequencies are used by global navigation satellite systems. And there's a bunch of these now run by different world powers in this 1200 to 1600 megahertz band. And those we kind of accept. We have those in our mobile phones, we have those in our cars, and we just use that. In most homes, we're finding more and more wireless technologies, cordless phones, cordless in the 900 megahertz band, so that's an unregulated band, but usually because it's in the home, it's not a problem. Remote controls use infrared light rather than radio. Wi-Fi is commonplace now in homes. It uses a band where it is lightly regulated. The equipment is regulated at very low power, so that all sorts of things are fighting in the same space for transmission and can interfere with it. So if I switch on the Wi-Fi on my laptop, I can see the networks in adjoining apartments in the apartment block I live in. Increasingly, people are running multiple games consoles, multiple printers, computers in their homes, and so we're having to find new spectrum for Wi-Fi. Bluetooth operates in the same, but that's very short range stuff. That's typically for things like headphones and peripheral devices. And then you get fancy technologies like charging. So this is contactless methods of recharging your mobile phone. And that uses very, very low frequencies. It's electromagnetic. And I had to check because I'd forgotten. Microwave ovens operate in the 2.4 gigahertz band, but shouldn't interfere because they're sealed in a box. If they're not sealed in the box, you're in trouble. We're going to see a lot more of this because we're getting a lot more electronic devices in the homes. We're getting everything networked. Networked thermostats, doorbells, lights. You can now get smart locks which say, yes, I know who's trying to deliver something. I'll open the door for you. Your bathroom scales connect to Wi-Fi so they can tell the app your weight, so that the app can then work out what your body mass index is and whether you should be doing something about it. Refrigerators will do automatic reordering, surveillance cameras, vacuum cleaners, lawnmowers, you name it, you can connect everything up. And for those of us who are locked down and can't go out to do exercise, you can get things like Peloton and Hydro, which will allow you to cycle and row with other people, but at a considerable distance, electronically connected. So the emphasis of the fourth industrial revolution, smart homes, is bringing many, many, many more of these in, which has two implications. One is that we're going to be using a lot more residential Wi-Fi, and the other is that we need some sort of connection to the internet from that. And we're also moving to world personal networks where we have cordless headphones, earbuds. I have a fitness band which will tell you my blood pressure. You can now just about get commercial for personal use devices which will do sweat analysis. You're getting wearables, and most of these are then connecting to the smartphones because the smartphone is really a computer. And so you end up with multiple radios, multiple antennas, and gyroscopes in it to see that you're moving, if you're moving, and compasses and all sorts. So to take a 4G smartphone as an example, this one's from Samsung. It will take two SIM cards so it can connect to two different mobile networks. It has five cameras on it, and then it has GPS, two Wi-Fi bands, a near-field communication connection, which for some strange reason, my credit card has lost its wireless capability. So I, for the last 3 months, have been using my mobile phone instead of a credit card, using the NFC capability. Bluetooth. The smartphone also has an FM radio in it. And then here we get to the really crazy stuff. It has four GSM bands, only three of which are applicable in Africa. The other is US. And then you've got a bunch of 3G bands and then a bunch of 4G bands. So that means that Samsung smartphone, if you take it into some different part of the world, some different part of the country, it will search for whichever network is best, whichever network it can find. And if it can't get you 4G, it will drop down to 3G. If necessary, it will drop down to 2G, and it will find a suitable band to let you do some kind of communication with that. And that gives you some idea of how sophisticated smartphones are these days. In terms of the number of bands, a 5G smartphone from the Chinese company Oppo, and it's got even more bands on it, and it's also got an additional Wi-Fi band, which is new band, which has been authorized in some countries. So it's got a compass in it. It wonderfully describes it as a geomagnetic sensor, but all it is a compass. So you're seeing yet more sophisticated phones, which means that when you look at the phone, much of what you're seeing is a set of aerials, antenna, round the phone in order to connect to the very many networks that you want. And that then allows you to take that phone. It will tell you your position. It's going to connect to the 5G network if one is available. It will connect to 4G. It will connect to Wi-Fi to offload it will connect to Bluetooth to connect all the devices around you, and it will do near-field communications to pick up information from adverts or to make payments in a shop so that you can be contactless. There's a whole bunch of other government uses of spectrum. Emergency services, how do you connect up the police, the ambulance, the fire brigade, the military, always difficult to find out what they're up to. They have large amounts of spectrum and don't always say what it's for, even to Parliament. The civilian radar systems, so that I can, in fact, go on and on my mobile phone, I can run a flight radar app and I can see which aircraft are flying over South Africa at the moment. Airports, aircraft, seaports all have radar systems. The military have a whole bunch of radar systems for their airports, for their aircraft, for missiles, for ships, and for other communications within that. So there are a whole set of commercial uses and a set of governmental uses, some of which are military, and trying to uncover that is quite difficult. We are all, I think, familiar with optical fibres running to homes. It takes a bit more effort to go out and look for the satellite links and the point-to-point links, but there's a lot of links around the country connecting high sites, terrestrial links, so one high site to another high site or a high site to a home. There are then satellite connections in more rural areas. If you're running, a game park or a mine in a remote location, then you're probably going to be on the end of a satellite connection. And so that goes up into geostationary or a satellite and back down again. Important for backhaul to mobile phone sites and other remote facilities. The good thing about that is that you can, if you've got point-to-point links, you can then reuse them. So they can be used on one link, and because they will not interfere, because they're very targeted and narrowly defined beam, then you can use them somewhere else as well. So we've had these slightly frustrating generations. The original, the first generation, was way back in the 80s. It went into the back of your car. It was screwed in and ran off the battery. It was analog voice. 2G came with what in 1993. It used them somewhere else.
Digital
as well.
Voice and text messaging.
The generations are terribly important to manufacturers.
Generation?
Much less so, I think, to consumers.
The original,
what matters
the
to consumers when you
back
do
in
that
80s,
is it getting
into
a mobile
the
phone.
Back of your car.
So 1996 was very important. But that was not in these generations. That was when prepaid came in. Then you move on
back
to
your car,
the big other change,
which
was smartphones.
Was very important.
It's when smartphones, which weren't a generation.
But that was not in these generations.
Within
that
generational framework, there was the call for yet more spectrum. Then you move on, more spectrum to carry more data, to provide more services because of the growing number of users. There is a trade-off here. The trade-off is that if you have more spectrum, you can serve more customers. But even with the existing amount of spectrum, you can serve more customers. So if you put in another cell, you can split cells and you can serve more customers. But that obviously has costs in it. So one of the challenges has been all constantly to go back and to ask for more spectrum, and that's defined globally, or close to globally. So we have these generations, and already, I hate to spoil this, already people talk about 6G, and there's quite a lot of work done on that at these amazing high frequencies. That's from the Japanese ministry. And it simply says that the data rate has gone up 10,000 times in 30 years. And we have gone through amazing changes, and that will carry on. That's just a complicated set of frequencies. That's from the European Union. So that's what they expect to be using for 5G. So a whole bunch of bands will be brought into play in order to provide services, basically taking all the existing bands and using them. So that's 1G, 2G, 3G, 4G, using it all for 5G and taking spectrum from broadcasters and keeping going and finding higher frequencies that you can use. Wi-Fi, I think, is now fairly familiar with people, but as you see, the original band wasn't enough, so we put in a second band, and there's a third band coming in. US has approved it, some other countries have approved it, others will follow. Because so many people are using this, so many applications, so many devices are in that space. It's unlicensed, but there are severe limits on the power you can use. That's so that you do not cause interference beyond effectively your own premises or your own campus or whatever set of buildings you're over 25 years now become commonplace in offices, homes, schools, cafes, etc. Interestingly, fairly large amounts of mobile data are carried on Wi-Fi. Customers go into their office or come home and offload the traffic from their smartphone. So the smartphone, as you saw earlier, handles many, many frequencies. They do that there. But that assumes that somebody's providing internet access. Originally DSL, increasingly the expectation is that will be optical fiber. And the speed of Wi-Fi 6 has now been taken up to 9 gigabits per second, which is really very, very impressive speed. So the Wi-Fi is faster, and it's doing all sorts of really quite clever things. And it sits in this band where you simply go to the shop and you buy the equipment and you plug it in, albeit that you can't be sure of the quality because you don't really know what other equipment you're running or which your neighbors are running. Is that when we're looking for new spectrum, we're typically looking at higher frequencies. Higher frequencies mean shorter distances and what the engineers like to call densification of networks. More masts, more antennas in urban areas, greater costs, and signals which sometimes are so weak they're stopped by walls and windows and all sorts of things. But what they're looking for are large blocks of spectrum so you can cope with these very, very high data volumes so that you can handle high resolution, ultra-high definition television, short distances, very high capacities, and then we start to get into some fancy physics with non-light of sight transmission. So this just shows you the technical characteristics. At the high frequencies, you get very little coverage. Maybe under a kilometer, but you can get a large chunk of spectrum there. And it's got fairly low latency. At the lower frequency bands, you can start to cover rural areas much better. And you can also go through walls and get good coverage in urban, suburban areas. But there's much less of that spectrum. There's other people looking for it. And it's somewhat slower latency. There's some fun being had over people claiming that 5G is responsible for COVID-19. And the World Health Organization in Geneva has said very clearly, no, it's not. And it's quite difficult to work out how radiation, electromagnetic radiation, would cause that. As they say, radio frequency fields just don't do those sorts of things. Right. We have typically assigned spectrum in the past by auctions. There are any number of ways that you can auction spectrum, but that's not an African perspective. Relatively few auctions have been conducted in Africa. There was one moderately successful in Nigeria. More typically, they have been by what are known as beauty contests. And the reason some countries don't like beauty contests is because they are susceptible to litigation, or indeed to corruption. In South Africa, the loser in 2000 brought a legal case, but that was fairly quickly settled out of court. It wasn't a legal action against the government, it was against players, so they paid the money and that was sorted. So it becomes a question of how do you assign spectrum to particular players? The challenge as a government, as a government, as a parliament, as a regulator, is that these are global industries. The technological advances are going to happen. They are driven by large-scale investments in research and development. One UK member of parliament commented, I haven't checked the numbers, but his comment was that Huawei had 80,000 researchers in its laboratories in China. That gives you some idea of the capacity they have to produce 5G and in 10 years' time, 6G. The network capacities increase. The technologies are embedded in our daily lives. Even if we don't appreciate it, we are typically now carrying devices and going into homes with other devices which are using multiple frequency bands. And those trends are not easy to control. There are trends which, in a sense, we have to live with. And to try to adjust and to move in a particular direction and to oversee, to scrutinize what is happening, to see who is benefiting, who is not benefiting, who is being held back, who is not being held back. But those technology trends are happening and they are being driven as much as anything else out of Silicon Valley and Shenzhen. And if we're not there, then we're probably going to have to live with that. But I think I should stop there. I'm surprised there weren't more questions, but let's see if there are any questions. Did I see Cameron yes, McKenzie with a hand up? Or was yes, that earlier?
That's right, Ms. President. It's me. Can I pose my question?
Of course.
Thank you. Just in terms of health risks posed by frequencies or radiations or cell phones, when you take, and this is a very common example, if I'm speaking and I hold the phone to my left ear, I have a problem with reception, you know, the call drops or cuts out or that sort of thing. If I switch ears, the call becomes very clear. I understand that something to do with the phone itself using your body or the electricity in your body as an aerial. Is that correct? And if it isn't, can you just expand on that for me? But if I can just congratulate you on your presentation, it was very, very clear. And you took some very complex topics and you made it quite easy to understand. So I appreciate that. Thank you very much.
I used to sit on a committee in one of the research centres in Denmark with someone whose job was to design the antennas. So The honest answer is that built into the phone are multiple antennas in different frequency bands, and there's a lot of design gone into that. To enable, one of the problems with consumers is they want this, the phone as the guys who design the antennas get upset because they would like to make them bigger. So there should not be a difference. The design of the phone is intended to be so that it will work with different frequency bands. It is not, as to the best of my knowledge, fancy with the electrostatics around the body, because it's so unpredictable how people will use the phones. Partly because a lot of people use a mobile phone can be two, three meters away.
Yeah, indeed.
I saw another hand. I think it was
Ms. Van Daan. I should look. Unmute.
My chief whip was saying unmute will be the phrase of 2020. Anyway, I was just saying thank you so much for the presentation. It's very, very fascinating, and it's great to have some intellectual stimulation. I guess this is a bit more for the chairperson of the committee. I don't know about other members of this committee, but we're constantly receiving communication from the public about 5G. And I think it's important for us as Parliament to put the public at ease, using the information that we've gained here, just to provide clarity that there are no real dangers. It's largely conspiracy theories. So thank you, Mr. Sutherland, for giving us this information, and thank you. Really great to learn new things. Thanks a lot, Chair.
Thank you. Yeah.
Are there any more questions before we move to the second part of the presentation? I think the second and third parts of the presentation will be even more interesting because they now begin to look at our own context. But is there another question, or shall we proceed?
Yes, thank you, Ms. Abrams. Just one small one. Ms. Sutherland, you spoke a bit about 6G, which made the hair stand on the back of my head. Knowing, I presume it's still in its infancy, the development of this technology, but knowing what you do know, do you anticipate that there would be the same kind of costs associated with the transition from 4G to 5G, from 5G to 6G? Do you anticipate that? Thank you very much.
Well, I think we'll come to that in time. The truth is that there are very substantial costs. 5G is not done yet, in the sense that the standardization process is still ongoing. There's a lot of that will depend on how it affects the marketplace, how people take up different elements of 5G. But there are a whole lot of people who are expecting to make a great deal of money out of 5G and beyond that from 6G. And that will cost the operators a lot of money to install. But if you go back to, even if you don't entirely believe the argument put by President Ramaphosa about Fourth Industrial Revolution, a lot of what we are talking about are going to bring economic benefits of that sort. They are to do with changing the way we do business, they are to do with teaching online, ordering online, doing e-commerce, doing digital government, doing all sorts of things like that. And therefore, there are potential economic benefits. Yes, there will be costs, but somebody somewhere will find the new applications. And part of the challenge is for, you know, to take one which is very South African, very much for Wits University, there is a lot of thought going into the mine of the future. Mines are dangerous places. They're very warm places. They're not pleasant necessarily to work in. And so the question becomes, how do you use the technologies to build automated equipment which will conduct the mine, which will do the mining without very many people actually in the mine? And that's the sort of thing which people are trying to apply the new generations of mobile telecommunications to, in addition to simply giving smartphones which allow them to watch or more YouTube.
So, Sazen, would you say then that the development of 6G would be a virtuous cycle of development?
No technology is like that. There are always downsides to technology. There will be challenges in 4G and 5G and 6G. There will be challenges to make sure it becomes available in rural areas. There will be challenges to make sure that there will be challenges to work out how do you take your business structures and get companies and individuals and entrepreneurs to do things with the new technology. At the moment, much of the revenue on 4G services goes to over-the-top services, which are not in South Africa.
Give us an example. So a service like WhatsApp, for example, would be in that line. Is that correct?
Yeah. So if you are doing Instagram or Facebook or WhatsApp, the data from using those applications is collected by Facebook and used to customize adverts to be directed at you. And that data is available to them in the United States of America. And they're taking the revenues from it. Once upon a time, there were large revenues for text messaging services in South Africa. Those revenues are collapsing.
Yeah.
Because people use free messaging services, which are, and you then get these highly targeted adverts to you, for which the revenues are accrued in other parts of the world. So the question, the same argument would be made, say, about Netflix. If you pay your subscription to Netflix, it then accumulates that money and commissions new programs. Does it commission them in South Africa?
Yes. I happen to know the production director for Netflix,
right,
in Cape Town. Yes, some of them anyway.
Some. So you what you then move from is it shifts from SABC to Netflix to other people. So you have then to think, but you can also then think, well, can you make videos with the devices? So there are going to be benefits. There are going to be challenges to existing business models. And you have to have people prepared and thinking about that. and thinking, how does this? So if I'm sitting in SAVC, for example, thinking everything is wonderful, I have got the spectrum to broadcast, and then I discover that people are subscribing to Netflix, and they're, it changes the business model.
Yeah.
And for you as parliamentarians, it's easy enough for you to drag the directors of SABC in and ask them questions. Netflix directors, somebody tried a grand committee of the parliaments of Canada, United Kingdom, Australia, somewhere else, and they tried to get the Facebook boss to come in. But only, and the US Congress has only just managed to get Bezos, the boss of Amazon, to come in. And that was under fairly severe threat. So from a parliamentary point of view, you have to wonder, well, who can we actually interrogate? Who can we supervise?
I thought we could maybe use, we've got about 8 minutes before we schedule to start the second discussion session. So I wanted to invite a few guests to contribute if they so wish. I see Pranil Ruplo, I see Richard Makgotlo, I see Councillor Nomonde Gongleka Siopa, I see Katerina Pillay, I see Tabiso Tukani, I see Dick Sono. Would any of the visitors like to contribute at this stage? No? All right then.
Right for now.
Okay. Thank you very much. I think then let's proceed to the second session. Ewan, back to you.
The question is, can I?
We can see. I can see. Is everyone able to see the slides?
Right. Okay. a long, long time ago, the Titanic sank in the Atlantic Ocean after running into an iceberg. At that point, before it signals, unfortunately, nearby shipping weren't listening on the right frequencies. And that led to some attempt to coordinate spectrum. So part of this is global assignment of bands. There are global technologies. As I've already said, we're looking at standard technologies. You could take equipment from a house in Pretoria, and the same technologies would be found in Shenzhen or San Francisco. So these are global technologies which we can use or not use as we choose. Central to that is this strange entity, the World Radio Communication Conference, from which flow allocations within South Africa, and we'll look at the generations from 2G onwards and some specific points about TV white spaces and one or two other quite specific areas of application. The International Telecommunication Union is described as a specialist agency of the United Nations. In fact, it predates the United Nations by, it has three different sectors, standards, where I work, standards, where I worked for a couple of years, development, which deals is there to support work in developing countries and the radio communication sector. Nations agree on the framework for spectrum, and this is in fact based on blocks of countries, so-called regions, with a certain amount of variation between them. So sometimes the frequency is slightly different in one rather than another. But even that is now being somewhat eroded because of the pressure to use equipment in certain bands. The ITU I don't wish to make a politically contentious point, but the ITU is in Geneva in Switzerland, in that rather uninspiring building, the radio communications sector, which has got on top of it a couple of 21 megahertz aerials, which you can't really see. It could be said a whole bunch of other United Nations agencies. So it's across the road from the World Intellectual Property Organization. Human rights are around the corner. The Refugees Agency is slightly from United Nations agencies. Across the road, the World Health Organization, who will quite happily make explain how safe or unsafe 5G is, and down at the bottom of the hill is the World Trade Organization. So there's this amazing cluster of organizations, interestingly shifting away from using in-person meetings. And COVID-19 has pushed them to do much more electronic meetings, but not yet for the big meetings. Big meetings at ITU can be 200, 300, 400 people in one place. In the case of the World Radio Communication Conference, they're there for a month. So the region that South Africa is in is Region 1, in two parts, but there's slight variations between the regions, but not a great deal. The advantage of Region 1 is it includes such a very large population that any standardization means that the equipment is being sold to a very, very large market, and therefore the equipment should be relatively easily available. The Radio Communication Conference has normally been hit. The so-called states parties sign the radio regulation. Sounds quite innocuous until you discover that it's an international treaty. And you might want to ask how exactly the government assigns responsibility to whoever is there to sign them on behalf of South Africa. So the two real functions, one is to finalise these regulations, and the other is to set out the work programme for the next conference. So if you were to go into Geneva pre-COVID days, to almost any day, there will be computer screens up displaying meetings for strange working groups looking at all sorts of subjects, which coalesce into these big meetings. So we've had meetings in 2003, 2007, 2012, 2015, and everything being equal, there will be a meeting at the end of this year in Sharm el-Sheikh in Egypt. And that will begin the work for the next cycle. So a big chunk of the work there will be setting out what should they do in preparation for WRC 2023. So this is a constant refurbishing, looking at which areas of spectrum are being used, which are being used well, less well, what has to be changed, what are the new technologies which are available. And the new technologies typically mean that you've got more throughput, that you can compress the radio transmissions, you can do more, therefore you need less space for traditional applications such as broadcast. That's what will come. And just to keep everybody on their toes, even before that event, the African Telecommunications Union is due to meet to discuss the future work cycle. So much like the generations of mobile, this is a constant process. It goes on and it goes on and it goes on. Now, although this is notionally an intergovernmental conference, it's not just governments and regulators. The manufacturers are there. So Ericsson, Nokia, Huawei, ZTE, these guys are there and quite prominent. The guys who make the semiconductors. To go back for 1 second to smartphones. Smartphones look all very clever. If you open them up, you find that some of that stuff is surprisingly like a commodity. So there will be a large chip in it for Android, for the Android operating system from Google, two or three companies. And so a number of handset manufacturers simply buy the chips and wrap their proprietary technology around that. So consequently, a bunch of semiconductor companies, Qualcomm, MediaTek, are there because they're very keen to see which technologies are going to be in their next generation semiconductors and in the next generation of handsets. And that raises very complicated questions about patenting. The other who are there in very strong numbers are the operators and their trade association, the GSM Association. Ironically, we are now onto 5G, but they still call themselves the GSM Association from. And one of the things which they're interested in doing is lobbying at this global level, because that will then, if they can get things at the global level, it will make it difficult to diverge from that at the national level. And they're also involved in lobbying at the regional level at the African Telecommunications Union and at CRASA, the SADC group of telecoms regulators. The groups who are absent from WRC are users, consumers, and non-governmental organizations. So it's a somewhat lopsided operation where as consumers or users, we have to rely on governments to represent our views. And at all times, there are operators and manufacturers lobbying them. So it's a complicated mix. And there has been a long argument between broadcasters and mobile operators over who gets the spectrum. The argument from the mobile operators has been, we need the spectrum, we provide better value for citizens, you, the broadcasters, are old-fashioned, you could go online, you could compress your services, but as we know, it is quite difficult to persuade older citizens that they want to give up their transistor radio in favour of a smartphone with a streaming service in it. So there are complicated arguments going on at WRC between different groups, and it's not transparent. It's a four-week meeting in normally in Geneva, this time in Egypt, or at least on the Red Sea coast of Egypt. Not easy to understand what goes on. Relatively few people do, and very technically complicated. South Africa participates in WRC itself and in some of the preparatory meetings. It's not always easy to justify going to Geneva for all the meetings. It then must decide how to implement the radio regulations, to specify if it wants to use a particular spectrum band, if it wants to do something particular. And then it sets that out in the national plan. And the national plan says which bits are used by the military, which bits are used for broadcasting, which for telecommunications. I was looking at a US government publication the other day, and it lists bits of spectrum used by the military. And it then said that the US Marine Corps used part of a band, but it declined for reasons of national security to disclose which band, which part of the band it was using. So there are all series of applications which flow from the national spectrum plan, from which we then decide what on earth we're going to do. Just for the record, the legal framework is there, the Telecommunications Act now repealed, the ICASA Act back in 2000, and the RICA Act and various amendments. The only the bit to draw attention to is the withdrawal of the amendment bill recently, which had spectrum provisions, which, because it was withdrawn, can't obviously be implemented. And that will presumably come back at some point. Maybe one of our guests would like to explain that one. To step back for 1 second and try to give a sort of theoretical model. If you go back before 1993, when the first mobile phone licenses were issued in South Africa, the state provided the telephone service. And that was common in nearly all parts of the world. The exceptions would be Spain, the United States, and Chile, I think. The typical model was the state itself provided such service as there was. Then we move into a world where we start opening it to competition. And that moves government and parliament into what is called a regulatory state model. And this is quite tricky for all the players. The market was opened to competition. For the record, the ANC opposed that. The National Party had dithered for 10 years about what to do. And then suddenly everybody agreed that it should happen. And that was settled by the Big Four. And suddenly we saw markets were being opened to competition. And that meant you brought in commercial expertise. You no longer relied on government bureaucrats to do things. You were bringing in managers with expertise. It brought in money. It brought people who were willing to cope with risk, willing to deal with technological change, people who had to decide, do we invest in 2G, 3G, 4G? How much do we invest? Do we just do it in certain areas, or do we try to roll it out more aggressively? It's easy enough to say, yeah, hey, we will roll out 4G, or we will roll out 5G, but by that, do we mean just in the city centres or in the whole of the country or the city centres, maybe in major routes? The attraction of the regulatory state model was that the risk was taken by the operators. And that left the ministry doing legislation and policy, and an independent regulator was created that stood between the markets and the government. So government did its bit on legislation and policy, the regulator did the more detailed work, and the operators engaged with the market. Of course, the operators also engage in lobbying and in litigation. And then Parliament, job of Parliament is to oversee the whole lot. They have to check what the ministry is doing and what the regulator is doing, and it makes life a bit difficult because they are trying to see what is happening in the market through this complicated model. But the alternative would be for the to go back to the state doing everything itself, and that makes for very, very difficult decision making. Then somebody else has to decide how much of the network do you want to build, how quickly do you roll it out, and those questions. South Africa borrowed a model from the United Kingdom, courtesy of some consultants in those days called Coopers and Lybrand. It had two operators, it had a regulator, and it limited the fixed operator to one half of one provider. And it introduced a number of service providers. So customers typically did not engage directly with MTN and Vodacom. They engaged with service providers who bought the service from the two operators. And that was that model was taken pretty completely from the UK in 93 with the two then international operators. One was the Vodacom, part of the Vodafone group, and Telkom, and MTN, which initially had foreign investors from Cable and Wireless and from SBC. And that proved to be a surprisingly successful model. Third operator was introduced much later. Many countries by that stage had four operators. There was a lot of discussion in many, many countries. How many operators do we need? How many will the market bear? The analysis by Satra in, 1999 would have been that the market could support two more operators. The minister decided only one. And the beauty contest selected Cell C, which is a slightly strange Saudi registered company belonging to a holding company in Lebanon, which sold out just last year, the year before, to South African interests. And as I say, there was some litigation over that. So it was an early stage model of saying, look, we're rolling out this service. Prepaid had come in, the market had greatly expanded. How many operators do you need in the market? Is it one? Is it two? Is it three? Is it four? There was no simple answer to that. The spectrum was available. The spectrum, if one is honest, had been designed to allow competition. Part of that design had come out of the US. Part of that design had come out of the European Union, which had by then somewhat enthusiastically adopted competition in mobile, and that became a model pretty much everywhere. The exceptions in Africa have been the Union of the Comoros, which resisted competition for a good many years and only capitulated, I think, 3 or 4 years ago, and Ethiopia, which still only has one operator but has promised to introduce competition. So although the minister said there shouldn't be a fourth operator arrived, but only in 2010 when Telkom came into the market. Telkom sold its stake in Vodacom in 2009. There'd been a long, long argument. Vodafone Group had two big arguments. One was in the United States, where it had a joint venture with Verizon, which it lost. And the other was in South Africa, where it had an argument with Telkom, which it won, and it got control. Launched initially Data, became Telkom Mobile, became Telkom. If you read the report by the Competition Commission on mobile data prices, data must fall, it effectively says, well, actually, it didn't have very much effect on the market, and it didn't increase the coverage or reduce the prices. That, I think, turns more to a criticism of the regulator, or it's a criticism of Telkom, and it's a criticism of the regulator, because you would expect over 10 years to have had some significant effect. So what starts off as an abstract discussion of spectrum and should we assign a group, then becomes the question of, well, how much spectrum do you give? Who do you give it to? How many players in the market? And how do you make sure it works? Rain, just announced it will expand to another 1,500 sites. Began as Wireless Business Service, changed its name, rebranded, launched the 4G service, then turned to 5G. And interestingly, Rain sells some service itself and wholesales to Liquid Networks and Vodacom. Now, it's worth flagging this works different ways. Liquid Networks, you would think of as a fiber operator. So you're now into a world where we think someone's providing a fiber service and a cellular service. So bundling the two together. So now you are taking a fixed service and a cellular service and combining them. And that, interestingly, is very much what's happening in the UK, where Vodafone is working with one of the with the cable operator, Virgin, in order to provide combined services. So you start to take the fiber infrastructure running to large numbers of homes and combining it with the radio infrastructure, which is also using the fiber, because you need the fiber in all the base stations. And you're offering a consumer a multi-place service so that they're getting all their telecoms with one bill and the networks all linked together. The Competition Commission was asked to review the mobile broadband prices, produced an interim report, had a consultation, and it produced a final report. And it got results. It struck agreements with the operators to reduce prices under threat of taking them before the Competition Tribunal and legal action. So it worked. But to get there, it had taken it a couple of years of analysis, a couple of public consultations, many meetings to analyse, to try to understand quite why it was that discrimination was going on. And so what you found from that was, first of all, there was nothing in there which was a very great surprise. There was nothing which couldn't have been worked out, certainly 7 or 8 years before that, if somebody had bothered to do the work. But you started to ask, in terms of spectrum policy, what had gone wrong with the introduction of the third, the fourth, and the fifth operator, which meant that it hadn't resulted in the goal set out in the legislation, which was that services should be available and affordable. Indeed, I think one criticism I would make is it's still not clear to me that we have a definition of what affordability means. But what we have from the Competition Commission report is something which tells us not about spectrum policy, but about the other policies around it, about how you implemented it. For reasons which other people might wish to offer, I'm not sure I need to go into that. But there has been a long gap in the assignment of additional spectrum by the government in South Africa. The operators therefore had to use existing spectrum for 4G, and that means gradually eliminating 3G, which is kind of fair enough, because you assume that people replace their mobile phones every 12, 18 months or so. So the smartphones are replaced. It's not a big issue if you move on. And the operators aren't stupid. They can see on their network operating systems, they can see who's using which type of devices, and they create incentives for people to move to new phones. Whether that's always wise is another matter. People very foolishly think they're getting free handsets or reduced price handsets, when often what they're doing is getting a phone and higher purchase. They just don't see the bills separately for the higher purchase. 4G enabled a lot more mobile broadband. but most of the offers were capped. Interestingly, for the offers, for the operators, a lot of the mobile traffic isn't carried on the cellular network. It's handled on Wi-Fi, Wi-Fi in offices, Wi-Fi in homes. Fourth Industrial Revolution stuff, Vodacom runs a narrowband Internet of Things network over its 4G network. And that then allows you to start doing some of the smart buildings, smart cities, and other applications. But migration to 5G for the main operators will require a lot more spectrum and new spectrum in higher bands for urban applications and in the so-called high demand spectrum. If you want any sort of rural coverage of that. So you have to, you have issues in here of market dynamics within South Africa between the operators, and you have issues of market dynamics globally, which is of the likes of Huawei and ZTE producing new equipment and selling it to the operators, which will do some of these quite clever things. There's no additional spectrum for 5G yet. The operators are reusing existing spectrum. RAIN is running 5G, providing that service. So we are the good thing is when you see the maps of 5G coverage in the world, South Africa says it's covered because the RAIN service is there. They colour in the whole country. But it's obviously not anything like national coverage yet. So the spectrum bands that have been assigned, 900, 1800, 2100, 2300 megahertz. We still don't know what, there's still a lot of work going on in 5G, and 6G, as we've said, is not at all defined. So it's been a slow process. There's been a delay in assigning additional spectrum. Quite a number of countries are dealing with a problem, which is that historically, we can take a very simple example. For complicated political reasons, Ethiopia decided that it would not issue any competitive licenses. So it's had a single operator, Ethio Telecom. That when they recently announced that they were going to offer more licenses, all sorts of people turned up and started saying we were terribly keen on having a license. Ethiopia's population is somewhere between, I think, 80 and 90 million people. The mobile phone penetration rate is quite low, so you could easily pick up 30 million customers in fairly short order. It's a very attractive option. The catch in most countries is that that's not true. The operators are very well established. The customers know who the operators are. They have SIM cards. They have brand names associated with them. They are sponsoring football teams, rugby teams, golf competitions, you name it. They are very well entrenched. And so the question arises, if you now have new spectrum for 4G or for 5G, can you sensibly expect a new entrant? And the honest answer to that is no. Many countries are struggling with a reduction in the number of operators. So we have seen mergers going on, four operators going down to three. We saw in South Africa over the last, 12 months, discussions about the viability of Cell C, which has, I think, just announced quite heavy redundancies. Amusing legal question, if Cell C goes bankrupt, who gets the spectrum? Well, I've looked through the Electronic Communications Act, and I can't see any mention of bankruptcy. So my guess is the Bankruptcy Act applies, and so the spectrum goes to the administrator in the event of bankruptcy. Now, that happened in the US. Same argument took place, and the courts decided it was the administrator, not the Federal Communications Commission. Now, more typically, you are seeing mergers. Small operator, third or fourth operator is bought up, or the third and fourth merge, something of that sort. So, in a world where you see consolidation, how do you assign spectrum? And one of the answers is then to say, well, we know who's going to get the spectrum. We can have an auction, but we know who will win. It will only be the usual suspects who get the spectrum. So the regulators instead have typically imposed coverage obligations. That may be a percentage of the population or the elimination of not spots or some, you know, a coverage in remote areas. Mr. McKenzie mentioned Inverness. Inverness, north of Inverness, would be a challenging area to cover. Covering Sutherland in South Africa and the area around it would be challenging. Major road and railway links might be covered. And some enforcement of the sharing of passive network infrastructure, so that's masts and towers. So that you can reduce the cost of building the network out. So there's no point in coming at spectrum and saying, yeah, we expect lots of people to build a network. When you say how many of those sites are already occupied by the existing operators, it's going to take somebody a long time to build a network out. It's going to be very expensive, and they're then going to have to fight to get customers away from the existing entrenched players. So yeah, new spectrum is wonderful, but it is not as competitive a market as you might wish. Getting spectrum is wonderful, but that only gives you the last bit, the last mile, or at some of the lower frequencies that you might stretch that to 20 miles. You then need to connect to some sort of core network. That can be done with fixed wireless. It can be done with fiber optic cables. It can be leased. So it might be Telkom or Infraco have cables in the area. And High Court opened up the capacity to build your own. So saying, hey, here's some spectrum is great, but to build a network is really quite expensive and quite time consuming. And that raises questions about who would want to enter a market and how long it takes you to recover the money. The advantage of giving spectrum to existing players is it almost instantaneously. A bunch of people already have point-to-point microwave links. That's just some names of it. You will see in there that some of those are telecoms companies. Some of those are anything but. There are all sorts of people have got a need for microwave links, some of them are universities. So you've got these frequency bands with the public facing part in the standard band and then the point-to-point links behind that, where microwave is still sufficient. But clearly at some point people will want to put in fiber in many cases, just because if you've got a whole lot of people watching high definition video, that's going to be what you require. Centec, we can probably not, there's really only one point to make about Centec, and that is that television white spaces is something which causes considerable excitement, partly because there's no license fee involved. In parts of Africa, very little of the television band is used at all. But everywhere there will be spaces. So bits of the television spectrum are used and other bits aren't. So there are gaps. And that varies by geography. Different channels are available in different places. So you can then build a very fancy database which says at this location, these frequencies are being used at this time. And people can then use that spectrum for broadband. In truth, to go back to WRC, this is possible because some of the television bands are used for mobile broadband in other countries. So another that regional map showed different regions of the world. So that what is in South Africa, the television band, is elsewhere used for broadband, and that then means the equipment is available. It does have this horrible technicality where you have to have this very fancy database to check that, yes, you can safely use that if you are in this particular place. Obviously, that's going to be a bit easier in some of the in some of the rural areas, or ironically, in some mountainous areas where you may not be able to receive the television signal. So the role of government has been to set out national spectrum plans. It means negotiating any interference with neighbours, which means that you have to deal with the mobile phone companies in South Africa and the mobile phone companies in Eswatini and in Lesotho to make sure that they don't cause too much upset, which is not so difficult because they're usually also South African operators. It's then a matter of allocating spectrum by whatever means is appropriate to broadcasters. Some work now at the moment on community broadcasting. Again, if you have frequencies which don't transmit long distances and which are relatively low powers, you can then have community radios, mobile operators, fixed network operators. Various attempts at fixed wireless services, which have been disappointing. Satellite operators, emergency services, and other users, like the airline. And then large amounts of spectrum used by the military, which may or may not still be used. Sometimes they have kept spectrum, which they have historically used, and not used it. Then there's a strange group of people called astronomers. Users in the sense that they broadcast, but they're users in the sense that they would prefer you not to broadcast because they want to be able to receive microwave frequencies on the likes of Meerkat and the Square Kilometre Array. So they they're looking for areas where people don't use the spectrum, and they really get quite upset when services come into their areas. But they are scientifically important and perhaps also seen as economically important. The roles of Parliament. Parliament gets to oversee ministers and regulators. It has to scrutinise legislation, which is very difficult because these are technically and economically complex issues. And it has to deal with the effects of the spectrum. So the effects are health. Is it safe? Do we have the advice of the World Health Organization to say, yes, it's safe? What are the market structures? What are the prices? And the one where I think I would be critical is we need a definition of affordable and unaffordable. Colleague then at Grahamstown, University at Rhodes University did work in Grahamstown and found consumers who had mobile phones but who could not always afford credit. So it was affordable and not affordable at the same time. We go back to issues of national competitiveness. Do we have the spectrum out there to allow people in tech hubs, the innovators, the entrepreneurs, to apply that technology to develop new applications, new apps and mobile phones, new devices, new personal devices that we can use, domestic appliances, or in factories and in mines, so that you can have fully automated robots working in mines rather than people, those sorts of applications. Thinking about that in terms of national competitiveness, how do we make sure that the technology is there to keep that going? Part of our problems are network economics. Network economics are, say, simple things like if we have the same global standard, it reduces the costs. So if we use the same technology everywhere in the world, then the costs dropped. And GSM prices dropped really quite dramatically because it was being used globally, and also, to be fair, because it was being manufactured in China, where the labor costs were very low. We get cheaper handsets as a result. We get cheaper equipment for the operators. We had three standards for 3G, but now we are reducing the cost of that. But even then, you saw that the 4G handset and the 5G handset were packing very large amounts of technology into what are really quite small devices. But the attraction under, you will get your unit prices much cheaper. And that should be then passed on to the consumers. Though obviously there will be large parts of the population who cannot yet afford smartphones, and that presents challenges to thinking, well, okay, we've 4G, we want to roll out 5G. How do we make sure everybody has access to that, given the challenges of the high cost of some of the equipment? A number of countries have tried not to license at the national level, but within units. The US issued hundreds of licenses for 2G, and it took AT&T Wireless about 4 years to build together a national service, which killed off most of the local licenses. India used to operate in circles, which were groups of two or three of their provinces, that you would have thought was big enough in a country of over a billion people. Strangely, that has now consolidated down to a very small number of national operators operating on this 1.3 billion, is it? 1.4 billion population. Interestingly, it's also been Indianized. The main operators are now owned by Indian billionaires. Russia had the same. It consolidated down to three operators. So there's a real challenge here of, say, if people start saying to you, could we not issue local licenses for mobile services? The global evidence is that for a variety of complicated reasons, that doesn't work. It tends to consolidate back to national levels where you get the economies of scale. And that's me.
Thank you. Thank you very much. So that's our second session. We have about 20 minutes now. If there's any particular slide or particular discussion point that members or guests would like to go back to, questions about relevance of these points in the South African context, and particularly to the role of Parliament. Let's see some hands.
No. Silent. Oh, Mr. McKenzie.
Yes, and yes.
And then there's Tanil, and we'll take a few more hands. I think let's do this. Let's have about three questions or contributions, and then so we'll take that first round of questions and then we'll have a second round.
Okay. Can I proceed, Chair?
Yes, you may proceed.
Thank you. Thanks, Mr. Sutherland. Also, very, very interesting presentation.
In terms of WTR treaties, and I've been privileged enough to serve on this committee for in the previous parliament, and have seen the treaties as our departmental officials negotiate them at the WTR. And I presume you have an eye on this. What is your opinion of South Africa's performance within the WTR? I am under the impression that we do incredibly well and that we punch well above our weight when it comes to driving the issues affecting our market, our region, and our continent. I'd be interested in your comments on that. I know these treaties that are signed at the WTR come to Parliament to be ratified. So, I mean, you seem to have a question around that. We do see these treaties as the entire Parliament. We speak on them and we approve them in Parliament. Also, the WTR, do you find there are very different positions between developed and developing nations when it comes to spectrum assignment? And where do these major differences lie? And then in terms of deadlock breaking mechanisms, do you have those within the WTR and how do those function? So that covers the WTR, Chair. I've got other questions. Would you like me to wait for those?
Yes, I think let's take those questions in the second round. Let's hear okay. from Tranil. And then there is also Dick Sono has posted a question. So we'll take those three and then we'll come back again. Tranil, please go ahead.
Thank you, Lucy. And thanks, Ewan, for an interesting presentation. You had mentioned earlier that there's a trend towards rationalization in countries where there's four or more operators. And given that may be an eventuality in South Africa, what's your view on the sustainability of the WOAN in South Africa, given that it's a certainty that the entity will come into being? And more specifically, what can we as custodians of the sector do to ensure that the WOAN will be successful, given the mistakes of the other countries? Thanks, Chair.
Okay. And then Dick Sono's question, which is in the chat, is, does Ewan think the introduction of ATA, now Telkom Mobile, a mistake? So we'll deal with those two, and then we'll have another round. Ewan, over to you.
Okay. We'll come to the WOAN a little bit later, if we may, because I'd put it into the next set of slides. The ATA question is an interesting one. The launch of ATA was a decision by Telkom, and I can fully understand that. They had been strongly present in the mobile market through Vodacom. They were bought out of Vodacom, though they didn't get much of the money. That was passed on to the shareholders. I would suggest that the mistake, if it was a mistake, lay with ICASA. It's clear, if you read the Competition Commission report, that the ability of Cell C and ATA to make an impact in the market was limited. That the conclusion Commission reached and that the tribunal upheld was that they frankly MTN and Vodacom had carried on regardless of the competitors. Now, that suggests that something went wrong in the management of the competition, that interventions could or should have been made to make sure that there was effective competition in the market. Would I criticize Telkom? Well, then the answer is Telkom, I think, has begun to get a bit more money back from ATA recently, so it's not critical. But to pick up, I think it raises a big question for Telkom. In the event that ICASA proceeds with an auction, the amount of money it's been making on Telkom Mobile is not such as to suggest that putting a lot of money into an option would be a good investment. So the what comes out of the, so the Competition Commission has dealt with, to some extent, the question of pricing and its affordability, but it, and some of the underlying competition questions. But the question you would ask is, if you were to hold an option, would it, would the conditions in the market be such as to justify Telkom spending a lot of money buying spectrum? Would it get back? And I think that suggests that something more structural, some structural changes are required in the market. If that's going to be the same issues, I think all would also logically must apply to the WOAN. The prospect of a completely new entrant into a market where there are well-entrenched operators who are comparatively strong financial players would suggest that's tricky. Mr. McKenzie asked about the difference between developed and developing countries. I think probably a more useful distinction to draw is between manufacturing and non-manufacturing countries. By that, I mean the countries that actually manufacture telecommunications equipment. So that's the likes of in East Asia, that's China, that's Japan, that's South Korea. It's the United States, although the United States doesn't do much of its own manufacturing. It does a lot of the design of the equipment. It's probably also Taipei, Taiwan. And then it would, in European terms, that would be Sweden and Finland and maybe Netherlands. And I think the difference there is that if you have if the minister announces that they're having a meeting next week about 5G or 6G. In South Africa, the people who come to that meeting will principally be operators. They may or may not be convincing. They may be wannabe operators, or they may be MTN and Vodacom, who are very well established. If you have that same meeting in Tokyo, you have sitting at the table NEC, Fujitsu, Toshiba, who manufacture semiconductors for that, who manufacture handsets. And that gives a very different dynamic to the discussion. They're the ones who are saying, yeah, we need to push forward. Japan hasn't done well enough in 5G. 6G has to be done better. In most other countries, developed or developing, it's a much lesser discussion. It's what technology will be coming to us, how do we deploy it? And I think that's the distinction that I would draw. There are a whole bunch of developed economies who, for the most part, will sit there quite happily and use that technology. It depends how sophisticated their operators are. I think that really the distinction I would draw. Measuring the effectiveness of national participations, national participation in intergovernmental conferences is really very difficult. What's important for South Africa to get from that? More spectrum in bands that are quite useful. But then it becomes, how well does it perform delivering with that spectrum? You know, the big argument of the 700 megahertz band. But the failure with that was to do with set-top boxes and digital migration and a whole bunch of other policy things. So a good result was achieved at ITU, but the implementation wasn't as good.
Okay.
So I think that answers that. And since you're kind enough to raise the issue of ratification, I would note that South Africa hasn't ratified, though it's signed, a couple of cybersecurity treaties.
Okay.
We have a bill before Parliament at the moment, exactly, on that issue, cybersecurity crime.
No, but South Africa signed the Budapest Convention of the Council of Europe, and it signed the African Union Convention on cybersecurity, but neither, the last time I checked, the instruments of ratification have not been sent to the Secretariat.
I'll ask that question in Parliament then. Thank you.
So we'll go into our second round, and that will be the final round for this session before we move on to session three. So in this second round of questions, I note first Alfred Mashishi, then the chairperson, Maneli, and then finally, Honourable McKenzie. So, Alfred, over to you.
Thanks a lot, Chair. I think my question is on the basis of the legislative role when it comes to the matters being raised by Mr. Sutherland. And my question is based on the problem statement. The first is regarding the international problem. My understanding is that it is more like when you talk spectrum ownership and allocation, it's more like dealing with a global peace. Who owns the peace? Because when you deal with global peace, is the weapons that you've got, you are able to enforce it. So the problem there is around tech-advanced countries that sort of dictate their agenda. Would that problem be fixed by us as a country sort of looking globally in competitiveness perspective on what is it that we carry as a influencer in order to drive? International. On a domestic level, I think is the issue around, you know, the analogy that says that policy does not mean law, and law and policy does not policy influence regulations, but not all law is policy, and not all regulations is law. So in that aspect, I think when you look at the role of government in terms of ensuring things like non-discriminatory access, the role classification, and stability in a sector. That's a problem that needs to be fixed around that domestically. And lastly, there's a sector problem. And in that, it's squarely on the regulatory model that you spoke about. Because when you talk about investment in infrastructure, the risk carrier is the one that caused the piper. So I think the dominance of the mobile operators, it's a bit of a something that we need to work on, because the competition is what is key. So on the basis of that, would you say that philosophically that's what could be seen as a problem? Thank you.
Okay, let's get the other two questions so that we, if there are any overlaps, then that all helps. Next is Chairperson Honourable Maneli.
Thanks, Ms. Abrahams, and thanks for the presentation, Mrs. Smollett.
Can I just interrupt you for a second? There's a request from Seminkosi Ngoma. When the presenter speaks or when someone asks a question or contributes, would you mind just putting your camera on, please, to speak on camera because the indication is that the seminar is also broadcast live on the Parliament YouTube channel.
I think I hope I can see. Connection has also been a problem to me.
Okay.
I just raise maybe 2 points for now. Maybe just 1 point. You mentioned that in 1999 there would have been a market study that showed that you can only be having 4 operators. May I then ask the question, going into this new auction, would you have advised that a market study should have been done before we get to that point? So that's one question. Question is a question that has been asked on one, but I want to ask it differently. That if you say, for example, in infrastructure, those who started before had an advantage of the state that invested before it allowed competition, where does it put one in this case, especially as it relates to the transformation agenda of the country, to bring those that have been previously disadvantaged on board, in particular in this sector? Thank you.
Okay. And then the final, thank you very much, the final question, Honourable McKenzie.
Thank you, Ms. Abrams. I have two questions, actually. You seem, Ms. Sutherland, to be quite critical of ICASA, our regulator, and you refer to the competition report. Are you aware that ICASA is currently undertaking a market review of the market? And they were obviously constrained. They don't have the same. The Competition Commission has a much wider mandate and a lot more power than ICASA has to conduct their studies. So they were able to come, deliver much quicker. ICASA is far more in depth. Are you aware that they're busy with this market review that they're still busy with? And why are you so critical of our regulator? Do you think they have failed to deliver the kind of competition or the kind of market that we have? Because I'm of the impression that we actually have a very vibrant and efficient market in mobile telecommunications. Then just in here, I found that market example quite interesting with a single operator that they've obviously had for a while. The ownership of that operator, does that vest with the Ethiopian government, or is it a private consortium or a hybrid mix? Do you know? And how does the cost of data and the cost of mobile communications in Ethiopia, if you have this information, compare with countries with similar profiles, demographic, social, and economic? Thank you very much.
Right. I'm not sure if I'm supposed to do something to get my camera onto the screen, but right. Let me start with the chairperson. There was a study in 1999 asking a simple question. We've got 2 operators. Can we take it up to 4? Today, the question would be, what sort of market structure do you think you can get? And you can compare that around. Now, to pick up the Ethiopian example, Ethiopia, for political reasons, decided they would keep a single state-owned operator, but then did a very complicated deal with Orange, France Telecom, for that structure. But that was ineffective. It just didn't pick up the customers in the way that almost every other country in the continent did. So the question you would ask is, going into an auction, can you realistically expect any more entrants? So you can do a market study. But if you go back to the Competition Commission report, it makes it very clear. MTN and Vodacom have been building their networks since 1993. They have geographical coverage. They have a very strong infrastructure. It's been upgraded over a number of years. They spent a lot of money building that up. Now, I don't know that any of that comes from the state. There must be telecom bits in there, but I don't. And it will have been replaced so many times over the years. But the question you would ask is, can you realistically expect a third or a fourth or a fifth or however many operators to come into the market? In the Ethiopian case, it's got relatively modest mobile phone density. It's straightforward. If you are thinking in South African terms, you are looking at two operators, which are relatively strong, and two operators which have fairly modest presences in the market. And the Competition Commission makes it very clear that they are not able to push the other two operators to change their prices. So the question you're left with is, who might conceivably enter the market now? And the other related question, you can think of that in two ways. You can think of that in terms of, if you offer a new spectrum license, would somebody build an operator, would they build a new network? And the other way you can think about it is, Cell C was in clear financial difficulties. How serious those were, I'm not sure, but it was in the newspapers. Who might conceivably have come in to buy it up? Because it's a choice. Do I go to ICASA and get a new license? Do I go to the administrator and buy Cell C in bankruptcy, where I'm going to get some infrastructure, some customers, and some spectrum? It might be a better deal. So you can think about market entry in those terms. And it's clear that there is not that much enthusiasm from the international group. You can turn that around by asking, where has MTN been able to enter? Which markets has it entered abroad? And it's entered places like Afghanistan and Yemen. Now, those are difficult, very difficult markets to go into. So it's not easy to think of people going to say, yes, the big option, one big option we've known in Africa for, but because Ethio Telecom had high prices, had low uptake of its services, it had all sorts of problems. It was a very attractive market. For the rest, if I'm sitting in Orange, or I'm sitting in some other T-Mobile, or a Latin American operator, Carlos Slim has the capital. I read the Competition Commission report, and I say, it's going to cost me a lot of money to buy into the market. Will I ever get that back? And the answer, I think many people would say, is, well, it's not going to be worth it, which is why you have a big discussion across many countries. Should you allow four operators to consolidate to three? Because you're going to have to put in a lot of new equipment in 5G and 3G. And you're stuck with that. The transformation agenda is a very difficult one if it's being asked in terms of how do you change the ownership structures of the existing players. That's going to be difficult to do. If it's being thought of in terms of creating some kind of new entrant to the market, then I go back to my previous comments, it's difficult to see somebody doing that And the only people I... Recent market entries in countries, very difficult to find. Some of you may be football fans and will be familiar with the name of Rakuten, which is a Japanese e-commerce company which sponsors somebody's football shirt. They are in the process of building a pure new 5G network in Japan. Not easy. Allegedly, it will cost them much less than their competitors. But they're a very big player. They're a high-tech player. They have entered that market reasonably successfully. But that, judging that, will take another 12 months. The other entry is in India, where Reliance built a presence across the country very quickly and has just received several billion, about 4 billion in total investment from foreign companies, but fundamentally an Indian billionaire building out the network. Otherwise, it's difficult to think of people in the last few years going in and building the network. So if the answer you want to the question of transformation is building a new operator, then the truth is you're going to have to put a lot of money in. You're going to have to back it, and it's going to take you time, and it's uncertain as an outcome. I'm all too aware that ICASA is doing a market review. I was slightly shocked by it because it seemed to try to describe a market structure and then admit that it was going to conduct a whole series of auctions. I think you have to look at the Competition Commission report and ask, how did we get where we are? And the answer to that has to be that third and fourth operators have not had much impact in the market. I don't think you can entirely attribute that to the operators. I think you have to say something was wrong with the regulatory structure or with the regulations which resulted in the inability of Cell C and Telkom to affect the market positions of the two larger operators. And something has to be done about that. Now, you can come back to two possible explanations. One explanation is that ICASA didn't have the data about the market, didn't have the capacity to get the data. The other explanation might be that the Electronic Communications Act of 2005 did not allow it to regulate in a way that would have created a more even and more balanced a competitive market. But if that was the case, then in a sense, ICASA should have been coming to you in Parliament and saying, hey guys, could we have some legal changes, some amendments, so that we can do these things. But you're stuck in 2020 with a market structure in which you have two large, and if we believe the Competition Commission, relatively independent players and two smaller players. What have I still to cover? Yes.
Alfred Masishi's question.
We are all in a sense we are all users. We are our technology comes from the large global manufacturers. They're relatively small numbers. There are four or five key players who make semiconductors. There are five people who make the network equipment. There are five or six who make the handset markets, who constitute the handset market. And the rest of us, what can we do? We can be innovative. We can use them. We can develop apps. We can do things on the edges. We can, but we are in a globalized world. And that affects how we think about how we use. So what we then have to do is to say, right, we are not suddenly going to become a manufacturer. We can turn to Mr. Trump for a second. Donald Trump wishes to try to bring manufacturing back into the US. He has so far persuaded one Taiwanese semiconductor manufacturer to build a new foundry in Arizona. So this is a silicon manufacturing facility. It will cost $24 billion over 5 years. It's a, and how much state aid will go into that, we do not know yet. So we're looking at vast capital investments to build the facilities to produce the chips that go into the network equipment and our smartphones. And so we then have to ask ourselves, well, what do we want? Whether that is Ethiopia or South Africa or the United Kingdom or the United States, which bits of that do we want to focus on? And how do we then formulate our laws, our policies and our regulations to deliver that goal? What's the objective that we're trying to get out? And no, it won't be stable. It will be constant waves of change. So we need to be flexible. We need to think about how we want to use that technology for our economy. How does it fit into an agricultural economy? How does it fit into a mining economy? This is then. For our policy, but we are in that sense stuck, that the technology is global and it's going to keep changing, and we just have to live with that. And it would have been a lot easier to deal with the dominance of the two large mobile operators 10 years ago, but something has to be done now. Bye-bye.
So I'm going to suggest that we move on to the third session. It's just about 2:15. These are all difficult questions to which there are no, I don't think Ewan is really answering the questions so much as we are engaged in a discussion. And of course, these questions, we can continue to pursue them in future engagements. But let me suggest that we now move on to session 3. And in that session, Ewan will partly tackle the issue raised by Tanil, but also come back to Tanil's question more comprehensively. Is that okay with everyone?
That's fine.
Yeah. Thank you. Back to you, Ewan. Session 3.
Right. The big question is, are we successfully sharing the screen?
No.
Not yet. We can't see the slides yet.
I don't understand. Is that working?
Yes.
I can't see it.
I think there's some kind of propagation delay.
Yeah, there we are.
Okay, let's proceed.
Right, let's go through this fairly quickly. So that's just a list of what I think are current issues: Fourth Industrial Revolution, COVID-19, 5G deployment, high demand spectrum, WON, 6G, and spectrum governance. So, Fourth Industrial Revolution, President Ramaphosa was really quite enthusiastic about this in the State of the Nation address, so much so he created the Fourth Industrial Revolution Commission, which produced its draft diagnostic report in November, which I don't think has been published, and we're awaiting the full report now for some weeks overdue, though there were some kind of bits of it released by Professor Marwala. And obviously, Parliament will be responsible. For oversight of that. The crucial point about 4IR is that it requires a great deal of networking. It requires the Internet of Things, and it requires the so-called industrial Internet of Things. So that's factories, that's robots, that's taking the physical wiring out of factories and replacing it with 5G at the moment. And so you're looking then at robots in factories, machines in factories, no longer hardwired through Ethernet, but wireless and with low latency and some really quite fancy technology coming in there. And that also, that's you know, my example before was that we're expecting that we are using that now in mining. Also, interestingly, the same technology is being used to disassemble electronic equipment to recover from it materials which can then be reused and recycled in new generations of electronic equipment. You are certainly looking at 4IR requiring 5G spectrum and 5G networks. And 6G networks when they become available. There's also quite a lot of work going on now to apply, take the spectrum and use it not just for mobile operators, but for what are referred to as economic sectors or verticals. So that's use of spectrum in particular applications in agriculture. And the implication of that is that we need world-class spectrum governance. So that's going to require a lot of flexibility, moving quickly. As you said, a lot of these changes are not being generated within South Africa. They're being generated outside, but they create enormous opportunities. And so we have to be able to respond to those. It also implies quite detailed understanding of markets and technologies. Who's able to do this? Who's doing this? What's happening? What are the trends? What does that mean for us? So can we get the information about the uses in, say, the agricultural sector and rural coverage? Do we have the detailed knowledge of that? And then whoever's in charge of this, can they be held accountable and transparent? Can they be dragged in before your committee to answer questions about them? And an issue there which is quite complicated is that it probably going to require quite a bit of coordination across government and at different levels of government. So it will require coordination between different government ministries and between federal, provincial, municipal governments. All of that is going to have to come together to deliver some of these things. So the Fourth Industrial Revolution, whether you believe in it or not, is a useful framework in which to think about, well, what are the economic objectives for South Africa? What is it that you would need to have? And therefore, what sort of spectrum governance do you need to feed into that, at very least to enable it, even if you're not at all certain how it will end up? Ironically, for all that we were told the Fourth Industrial Revolution would be revolutionary, it turned out that COVID-19 moved things a lot faster. People started using e-commerce and working from home and doing all sorts of really quite clever things very quickly. Government also moved rapidly. The president announced the State of disaster, the minister gazetted the regulations very quickly. The Minister of Communications issued emergency regulations, and ICASA assigned Spectrum to operate it really quite remarkably quickly. Not an uncommon problem around the world. A lot of governments were looking to much heavier use of mobile networks, fixed networks. There was a big, unexpected jump in voice telephony. Voice telephony has historically been declining as people move to WhatsApp and FaceTime and similar systems. Suddenly, people switched back to voice calls, longer voice calls, and global traffic volumes in that changed overnight. Very strange. So ICASA found that it had a whole lot of spectrum, and it issued them, it was able to issue them to the operators, and it's due to expire 3 months after the termination of the state of disaster, or no later than the 30th of November 2020. You get some idea on that slide of the scale of the spectrum that was released, which is really quite a lot of spectrum. Now, it has to be said, the obvious advantage is if you are a big operator with a lot of equipment out in the field, as soon as you start to get that spectrum, you can deploy it really quite quickly. You saw 700 to 800 megahertz is wonderful spectrum. People are very keen to get this because it has long range of coverage, and it's pretty good at going through windows and walls and so on. So it'll give you some decent in-building coverage, much less so at the higher frequencies. But suddenly you saw these big blocks of spectrum released. And down at the bottom of that slide, you see some television white spaces spectrum issued, subject to some rather complicated location conditions. In other words, making sure that their broadband that they were providing on the television white spaces wasn't interfering with people's televisions, not least because people were spending more time at home and therefore likely to be watching more television. So what was impressive about this was the amount of spectrum which was available and just how quickly it could be got out the door. I should say there's a whole lot of people were upset by that because they didn't get the spectrum. But I think the explanation for that is principally that these were the guys who had the capacity to use it very quickly. And that gives us an indication of just how much spectrum there is held. 5G is moving pretty rapidly. For something which isn't fully standardized, we're expecting some standards next month from 3GPP. Smartphones and other devices are available. They're not cheap. Prices are coming down. But that's always been the case. That was true with 2G and 3G and 4G. The handset manufacturers just take a certain amount of time to get it out. And there's some quite interesting work being done on using 5G, not for smartphones, but for fixed wireless access. So that would be to take it into point to multi-point, take it into homes and give you an alternative to having copper wire broadband or indeed fiber optic broadband. And there's some very interesting discussions around that, though it's far from clear whether it can really replace fiber. Some of the manufacturers rather, with installed network equipment, it turns out to be a lot more complicated than 4G. There are more manufacturers involved, there's more software tools, they are starting to use artificial intelligence in the networks, they're using open RANs, it's getting very complicated, there are quite a number of operators who in the past have simply have commissioned manufacturers to build the network for them. That's going to be more difficult now. There's some growth in data consumption. There are crazy people in Finland and in South Korea who are using really very large volumes of data. But again, these are people who've got no cap on the download, and they're consuming fairly large volumes of data. We don't think that's going to bring any new revenues for the operators. The operators are going to get their revenues from industrial applications, Internet of Things, rather than people watching Netflix or using WhatsApp. So we're globally up to something like 80 operators worldwide have launched 5G services. So we're going fairly quickly for that. South Korea, South Korea is always one of the slightly crazier places, countries, very, very technology focused, strong manufacturing base. They make their own semiconductors, their own handsets, their own network equipment, and they have activated 100,000. Now they're getting towards 100,000 base stations are built, and something like 80,000 have been activated. So they're moving quite rapidly. South Korea is always very interesting, geographically, historically very strange. The country was leveled in the early 1950s during the war. And rebuilt in very, very densely populated. Most of the populations are in six cities. But very, very, always very interesting to visit because it's at the advanced edge of technology. They're doing much more. Nonetheless, there's a government inquiry going on into the quality of the service. So there's a lot of 5G, but they've already launched the first inquiry into the quality of service that's being delivered to consumers. China looks to be approaching 100 million, sorry, 5G customers. I think there's a question as to whether they've actually got 5G handsets or whether they're just in 5G subscription plans. But yeah, that's kind of what you expect. These are competing state-owned mobile operators, but able to buy their equipment domestically. China Mobile has just done a big order with Ericsson in Sweden. So we're looking at pretty steep slopes, fairly rapid advances on 5G. The United States of America, this is not just Donald Trump. The US Congress since about 2012 has been trying to get Huawei equipment out of the US domestic network. One of the U.S. senators was giving evidence to the House of Commons in London the other day, and he basically said Huawei is an arm of the Chinese Communist Party dedicated to the overthrow of Western civilization. U.S. operators are presently forbidden to buy Huawei equipment because of the cybersecurity threat. And the rip and replace for existing 3G and 4G equipment was passed into law, although it says so 2019 Act, it was only signed in the early part of this year by President Trump. The US is also pressurizing some of its allies to ban it, and was the other day threatening to bribe operators in Brazil not to buy Huawei equipment. They are providing state aid for domestic development of 5G, and they are also trying to kill Huawei by blocking it from buying semiconductors. Complicated story. The US used to make semiconductors. They decided it was too expensive way back in the 60s and started to farm out the manufacturing parts to Asia. So now a company like Qualcomm designs chips in San Diego, but sends those designs to Taiwan to be made and to China to be made into semiconductors. So the US is now trying to block Huawei from doing the same thing. So the Huawei has a large semiconductor business, but it doesn't make the semiconductors. It designs them, passes the designs to Taiwanese companies, and the Americans are now trying to block that, with the clear intention of killing Huawei. But nobody much is buying that. Some UK is looking at not including Huawei equipment, Germany a little bit, but otherwise no one else really believes that Huawei is dedicated to the overthrow of civilization. That's the existing, that's the pre-COVID spectrum assignments in South Africa. And as you saw from the previous slides with COVID, a whole lot more has been made available. So it's getting quite interesting now as to what's going to happen. There is this so-called high-demand spectrum. Why is it high demand? It's high demand because it's in a band where the equipment is readily available. It's in a band where it will travel quite long distances. It's quite easy to install. It will go on existing masts without any difficulty if you're given the spectrum. As happened with the COVID emergency, it's deployed fairly quickly. So South Africa had consequently, because it hadn't been issuing the spectrum until a few weeks ago, it had fallen quite badly behind some other countries in Africa, and certainly the BRIC countries have been very enthusiastic about this. So mobile operators were able to go from 2G to 3G to 4G to 5G basically by reusing spectrum. And that gets quite interesting because they then have to take a commercial judgment as to how they use the spectrum. Part of that problem was the long delay in digital migration to get broadcasting out of bands that were wanted for mobile. And as I say, I think the digital launch for that was in at ITU event in 2008. So there was to be an auction which may or may not still go ahead this year. With however, as a matter of policy, most of that spectrum was to go to this so-called WOAN. The WOAN is an idea which very probably comes out in New Zealand, where it's known as a spectrum park, but proving that's quite tricky. The catch with building a wholesale open access network is you do have to build a network. And then you have to lease the capacity on your network to service providers. It's conceptually very interesting. 5G technically allows you to do that without too much pain, but that means building a brand new all 5G network, which would certainly be time consuming and interestingly expensive. The only example anybody's ever quoted is the so-called RED is the Spanish word for network, RED Compartida in Mexico, but that's never been built. Partly, I think it was intended to be a rival to the Carlos Slim America Mobile network, but AT&T has built a network there. So the idea of going up against two operators with extremely deep pockets, Carlos Slim is the richest or second richest man in the world. It's not really very... So as far as anybody knows, the Red Compartida has not been built and probably won't be built. It may have been some sort of strange artifact of some political changes that were going on in Mexico. The same people, Rivada Networks, floated the idea in the US, but that died pretty quickly because the argument was made that all it was doing was it was putting Rivada between the FCC and the customers and taking money for no very good reasons. So the question you have to ask with the WOAN is, can somebody raise the money for national infrastructure? But you also have to ask, can these so-called service providers raise the money for their businesses so that when the WOAN is built, that the WOAN will get revenue because it's a wholesale. It needs retail. Will there be the retail providers there? And there's a couple of legal questions in there. One is it looks like there's a legal window of only 5 years, which might not be enough time to recover the money. And, of course, the other possibility is whether you would be able to withstand litigation in the court. It's very complex regulation. So question to CASA would be, does it have the spare capacity to regulate it? And which other wholesale markets has it regulated? And just a very big basic piece of engineering, how long would it take to build this sort of network? And this is not helped and not helped in the least by COVID-19 making the economy a good deal more difficult to predict, a good deal more difficult to suggest launching fancy new services in. But that's you know, these things happen. 60, the manufacturing nations have begun the preparations. We're underway. Research is underway in China, Finland, Japan. Finland had its second annual 6G conference a couple of months ago. Japan insists it will beat South Korea on 6G. South Korea says they will beat the Japanese. Sweden is very keen. The US is very keen. The US wants to be the definitive leader in this. And the rivalry is to be who first to deploy around 2030. So 5G is not, as some people have been saying, you know, that's it, or is not even definitive. 5G comes in three different releases, and in all probability, that will simply be different versions of 5G. It will probably be called 5.2 or 5.3 or something, and then 5.4, 5.6. as we go through to the end of the decade and yet more technology is sent to us. So we're now waiting for the World Radio Communication Conference in November. We'll find out what the treaty says and what the successes and failures are and what the issues will be through to 2023. So we then need to ask, well, what would a position for South Africa be? What does it want from satellite services, from 6G? What does 4IR require? What's the important related question is who's lobbying? Who's and the answer, the usual suspects are the big operators. But who else is there? What should be the position it taking, given that you are then looking to a position in 2023 and beyond, when you're thinking in terms of all sorts of new technologies that you would be using in economic sectors as well as in homes. Other question is, do you shut down GSM? Now, there's some fancy engineering solutions around which say, no, you don't. You have very, very clever base stations which recognize that this is someone using an old-fashioned technology. We can still cope with that. But there's a lot of spectrum in GSM. It's low frequency. It's great for long distances. It's wonderful for rural areas. You could also use it for 5G and 6G. So is it in the public interest to shut down GSM? If it is, when? I hate to draw the parallel, but one of the parallels might be set-top boxes. You might have to go out and find older customers. I say that as someone who's in his 60s, older customers who might want to be persuaded to give up their GSM phone and take something more modern. When do you do it? What's the political decision to balance the old uses and the new uses? What interventions would you make to encourage customers to move to those new generations? And then you've got an interesting problem. There's a whole bunch of things out there which have GSM in them, which aren't human beings carrying phones. So car trackers, there are some smart meters with GSM in them. So there's a whole bunch of things. So there's a sort of consultation process of asking people, excuse me, how many cars have these in them? What's the replacement cycle for cars? How do we do that? But there's an issue which says that the mobile operators would like to take that spectrum from GSM. And there may be an engineering solution, or it may be something a bit cruder than that, that requires some sort of intervention. Quite different issue. IMSI grabbers are around, also known as IMSI catchers, also known as Stingrays, which is a brand name. These are fake mobile base stations. These talk to your mobile phone, pretending to be a base station, and they ask your mobile phone, would it please tell it the handset number and the SIM card number. And once you've got the SIM card number, you can obviously link that to Rika data. And there, I have to make a declaration at this point. The declaration is that, to the best of my knowledge, I am not related to Roland Sutherland, who is the judge in the case in the Gauteng High Court. So if you have one of these MC grabbers, and let us say a demonstration walks past one of these machines, you can pick up the name, the numbers of the mobile phones. You can then, with the Rika data, identify who those people are. There were two major incidents. One of them was in Parliament at the, and I should have put the year in, the State of the Nation address by Mr. Zuma, when the phones were all switched off, which I think was 2016. And the other was a more, even more bizarre incident where some individuals were caught at the Irene Mall with one of these IMC grabbers, the circumstances for which I think were discussed in the Pretoria Magistrates Court, but I certainly never understood them. And so there are challenges here. From a parliamentary perspective, the question is, who oversees the use of these things? We know there are several of them in South Africa. We believe the intelligence services and the police use them, but what are the policies for them? What are the issues? And even a mundane question, do they work at the higher generations of technology? So we're still waiting for the Constitutional Court to rule on the appeal against the decision by Judge Sutherland. Right, your guys' job is to keep an eye on the minister, the regulator, the operators, the broadcasters, the markets, the over-the-top providers who aren't based in South Africa, are quite difficult to get to. And then thinking about how might we deliver things like availability and affordability. There are out in the commercial world any number of reports about some of this stuff. The GSA does up-to-date reports on 4G, 5G, the equipment, the networks that are deployed. Open Signal tells about the quality of networks. Deficient tracks the same sorts of issues, numbers of customers on 5G, on various networks and operators, a whole bunch of consultancies. There are then some think tanks, but you have always to ask with them, are they as independent as they make out, and who funds them? And if they don't say who funds them, then you get a bit worried. It usually turns out to be Facebook or Amazon or somebody. Other parliaments are deeply engaged in this. I gave evidence last year or the year before to the UK Parliament on 5G. The European Parliament has done reports. We sent you, I think, a bibliography, which has got some of the reports by other parliaments, including ones I like. House of Commons Library does nice reports, which are usually quite straightforward to read. And other parliaments are taking evidence from independent experts on issues. The US Congress has looked at cybersecurity of the Huawei equipment. UK Parliament has looked at rural coverage. The whole bunch of the European Parliament has done similar sorts of work. And we've given you a list of some of them. We're happy to provide more if that's at all helpful, or make contacts. So spectrum is a big challenge. It's a very difficult one. The markets are at one remove because there's you, there's government, there's regulator, there's markets. You're overseeing a regulator which oversees the markets, which just makes life difficult. It does require quite detailed information from regulators about market trends, revenue trends, technology trends. And obviously, operators are lobbying in favour of their businesses. Where do you get the countervailing views from? Where do you get the users? Where do you get the NGOs who will say, no, this is the view of what poor people think, what people who are not being served think? And you come back to this, to one problem, which I find slightly disturbing, which is we still don't really have a definition of affordability. But I think I should stop there.
Okay, thanks. thanks, Ewan, for that third session. There are a couple of questions and a comment already in the chat box. There is Alfred Mashishi. There's Dixono, and Christoph Stork says that Red Compartida was built and is operational. So perhaps you could deal with those. I also see a hand from Honourable Mackenzie, and we can just check if, in fact, perhaps we should start with that. Just check whether Pranil was happy with the response. Pranil?
Thanks, Chair. Ewan, I'm not sure if you exactly went through the steps that you should take. I was probably looking for something more specific. I think that if we know that there's been issues with the WAN, and that's around the world, and that's well documented. So my question was, looking at the issues around the world, what can we do to preempt this and try to make this a success in South Africa? Thank you, Chair. Thanks, Ewan.
All right. So over to you, Ewan, Pranil, Ruplow, Alfred Mashishi, Dixono, and a comment from Christoph, if you can just respond to those.
Right.
And I see also Honourable Mackenzie, and I see Richard Makhotlo. Go ahead.
You want me to go now? Okay. What makes it a success? You have to get a clear view of what the time frame is going to be, the chairperson asked about a market analysis. That's going to be central. You have to understand what the WAN is trying to do. What has and what has not worked in the past. So you're going to have to understand which bits of the technology are affordable. How do you build out a network? Do we have a cost for that? What is a reasonable time period in which to build that out and to recover the costs? And how do you then make sure the service providers also have the money? So we're looking here at two lots of money. One is the investment in the infrastructure needed to build a WAN, and the second is to have the money available for the service providers. What is it they're going to be doing? Now, there are a bunch of technologies out there that you could conceivably use. As I say, in Japan, Rakuten is has built a brand new, very sophisticated 5G network. And that's a model which is well worth looking at. The claim, it will have been half the cost of a conventional network. If that's true, that would be amazing. It is also a type of network which allows you to do some very sophisticated leasing of the capacity on the network. So it is possible. But then you have to be thinking about who the service providers will be, what their business plans are. Are they going to be there in time? So it's a very complicated and sophisticated challenge. But it pays then to go back and ask, why is it that ETA, Telkom, whatever you want to call it, was less of a success than it could have been? And why couldn't it come up with a plan that would justify Treasury in investing in it? So you're drawing on a very small base of experience of these sorts of things in other parts of the world. You're drawing on sort of a concatenation of a sequence of, you need to get somebody who can successfully invest in the network, you need to get it rolled out relatively quickly. You need then to get the service. Now, part of that's going to be, has to be, getting access to things like base stations, something again flagged by the Competition Commission. So it's going to take a lot of regulation. So you then have to go back and ask, does the existing legal framework provide the regulation that you will need in order to make a success of the WOAN? Now, one answer to that might be, no, we're not going to regulate it. It'll be done purely commercial. I would be surprised if that succeeded, but it's a plausible model. But then again, you would want to be going back and asking, well, what undertakings do you take from a WOAN operator to make that work? Because that will be very difficult. But it's a complicated process that we are talking about here. It's a messy process, and you have to accept that there are risks that it might not work. So there's a risk that if the decision is you're going to go down that route, then fine. That's governments do these things all the time. And 5G is a technology which potentially does that. It has something called slicing in it, which would do that. But it implies so many things, so many contingencies of, do you have access to the physical infrastructure? Do you have access to the backhaul? Do you have all of those things? And the one which, to be very honest, terrifies me is the litigation risk.
I wanted to make a quick comment here, but when you're done, Ewan, and I also just wanted to note that we've got about 8 minutes left and quite a lot of questions.
Sorry. It's just that wholesale models on a commercial basis can work, have worked in some cases and in some countries. If that's what you're doing, it's a decision you have to decide. Do you do a wholesale network, which is regulated, or do you not do it regulated, which is very, very different.
So my quick comment was going to be, we were discussing this in class last year, and there is a form of modeling, which I'm not aware whether regulators have used this form of modeling, but it's an interesting form of modeling. It's called digital twin modeling. And what that means is that when you have a problem that you don't know the answer to, and this is mostly used in the engineering environment, but there's no reason why it can't be used in the context of a very complex question like this WOAN question, is that you model the question in the digital environment. You model the problem in the digital environment. You pose a range of solutions. So this would obviously require a kind of data analytics. And I think that is something we need to explore. The idea of attempting to answer our questions through modeling, through scenario building, which of course is part of market analysis. But I think often when we use the term market analysis, it kind of, you know, it's a little bit of a black box, and we need to look at what goes inside that black box. What are the kinds of modeling techniques and scenario building techniques that give us different answers to influence decision making. Now, I also see Christoph. I want to invite Christoph. You've made a comment in the chat. If you can just say something very quickly, and then we'll get back to the other questions.
Yeah, from my perspective, the Wuhan virus was perceived as a solution to problems in 2013 and 14. And by now, the landscape has changed, and both rain and liquids provide wholesale services to Vodafone and Vodacom and others. So by now, the Wuhan would only make sense in a virtual sense, where mobile operators could dedicate certain base stations to a virtual Wuhan, and therefore can then use certain frequencies. But otherwise, it would not be commercially viable. It would be impossible to compete with the large networks. It would be too expensive, and there isn't really an economic need for it anymore.
All right. Thank you, Christoph. So then if we can get back to the questions of, I think, Alfred and Dixono, you and you can see them in the chat. And then finally, we have two hands. We have Honorable Mackenzie and we have Richard Mahotlo, and that will end the session for today. So, Ewan? Question, does the expansion of the 5G technology spur the rapid urbanization movement, but also curtail the mobility phenomena that spurred the mobile technology? Mm-hmm. Question, Nokia downfall syndrome emerging again. That's Alfred's question.
Well, Nokia failed in handsets, but Nokia is now one of the world's largest manufacturers of network equipment. So I don't think there's any attempt by the manufacturers to restrict this to urban settings. I mean, the intention is to make these are to be universal networks. I mean, a big function or one of the big sectors of application is in agriculture. And there's a lot of work on bringing satellites, and in particular low Earth orbiting satellites, into the constellation of devices providing the spectrum. So I think mobility is, if anything, increased. I mean, yes, you have to densify the network. You have to do all sorts of very, very clever things to make it work. In a sense, Nokia downfall works the other way. That tells you there's an amazing amount of innovation in the handsets and in the peripheral devices. The question about the new radio and standalone and non-standalone, we could be here for the rest of the afternoon talking our way through that. I mean, at the moment, the operators are deploying the networks relatively rapidly. There are all sorts of complicated questions about how quickly they will move to some of these new radio versions. But I think that's just going to take time. It will depend how expensive it is to put it out. It will depend how difficult the engineering proved. I mean, one of the big questions you have to ask concerns systems integrators. How good will systems integrators be at building the network? And where did the money come back? Remember, when people talk about 4G or 3G or 5G or whatever, it's a bucket of technologies. They try it on consumers, and consumers like bits of it. They reject bits of it, and it takes longer to get the money back. So I'm not really that worried. That will just take time. What have I missed? Or is Alfred ready? Is it Alfred? Is no, Richard going to ask a question?
Yes, Richard, and then I think it was Honourable Kenzie first, and then Richard.
All right, thank you. Let me just put on the camera. There we go. Mr. Sutherland, thank you very much once again. Just in terms of the allocation of spectrum, you made a comment that our failure to allocate spectrum in the past has led to us actually being slightly backwards compared to our neighbouring countries. Big problem. that failure has kind of retarded our growth and development as an industry. And it amazed me also how quickly the spectrum was allocated when the COVID emergency arose. Given that it's an infinite resource that you can actually rent and earn revenue, I'm amazed that government never did this temporarily in the past. Now, here's my question. In terms of the allocation of spectrum, do you think, firstly, it was allocated efficiently? Because I understand that for the rollout of 5G, you need a contiguous block of spectrum. You need perhaps 50 megahertz or 30 megahertz, but it must be contiguous in order to roll out that network. Do you think ICASA allocated that spectrum efficiently for that purpose? And would you recommend that ICASA carry on temporarily leasing the spectrum to mobile network operators until it's in a position to hold the auction that it's decided on? My first question. The second question is around the Huawei. There was an incident in the past where Huawei had built in backdoors into their networks that they could in fact access the networks regardless of who owned them. And that led, as I understand it, to the concerns around the security of Huawei networks. Huawei have said that they've removed those backdoors and they don't install them anymore. But do you think that's a valid security concern for anybody considering that equipment? And I was also very pleased to hear you mention Nokia as a major supplier of 5G, and I'm certainly going to look into the Japanese thing, because that's very interesting. Then finally, in terms of the WOAN, as I understood the formation of the WOAN, let me talk to the chairperson's comment on transformation. As you know, our economy and our society has been heavily skewed in favor of the white community or white people because of the past. So clearly in the last 25 years and going ahead into the future, you want to kind of normalize our economy and ensure that those historically excluded from the economy are given an opportunity to participate. You've indicated that the investments required in rolling out network are massive. And I think people, the government took that into account. When the concept of the WOAN was thought up, it was that a block of high demand spectrum would be given to a WOAN company. The WOAN company would then, in exchange for that spectrum, be given access to existing networks. So they wouldn't have to build their own networks. The existing mobile network operators, in exchange for access to the spectrum, would provide access to their physical networks. Do you think on that basis that the WOAN could work? That's my first question. And in terms of transformation, I think the emphasis seems to be, how do we get people who are historically excluded, assuming that there's nobody included at the moment, how do we get them included into network ownership? My question would be, if we accept that the network ownership thing is beyond the reach, how could we make our sector, what areas would you suggest people look into in the telecommunications sector beyond the actual physical network? So in other words, the services on top or something else that they could provide in order to make the industry more inclusive. I hope that's clear. Thank you very much.
Okay, and then let's just have Richard's question before you and then wraps up on everything. Richard?
Yeah, thank you very much, Chairperson, and thank you for the opportunity as well. My comment is mainly on regarding the 5G development, that South Africa is, or the administration of South Africa is involved within the ITU process of the development of IMT 2020 technologies, which is to lead to 5G. So my question would be, what advice would you give in order to be able to encourage manufacturing of those systems which standards have been developed with the input from South Africa? But to ensure that the uptake can be made with regards to the manufacturing of those devices and applications. Thank you very much.
Right. If if I was from one of the big operators, I imagine I would be very quietly, this is in answer to Mr. McKenzie's question, I would think I would be talking to Treasury and indicating a willingness to pay substantial amounts of money to retain the spectrum. I think I think the obvious thing from their point of view would be to carry that on. Dr. Stork makes the suggestion that it could be a virtual one, which I find somewhat complicated. So I think a crude solution would be to carry it on. I believe that the introduction of income tax in the United Kingdom was undertaken by Mr. Pitt as a temporary measure in the early 19th century. It remains in place. So it would be quite possible to roll the spectrum forward, either in the hope that the economy would pick up, or in the belief that you might want to then do some kind of more detailed economic analysis as to the markets. And as Dr. Stork says, the original concept of the one was done some time ago, and not least in the generations of the technology and in thinking about 4IR. If you are interested in the security of Huawei equipment, there's some quite interesting work done by the United Kingdom National Cybersecurity Centre, which appears to have been over the software with a fine-tooth comb and assessed it. The European Union has some mitigation methods against that. Basically, the answer is if you keep the Huawei access in the test network and you don't give them access to your current network, you're relatively safe, in the same way that every day or so my mobile phone updates software. One of the risks is that you get a software update on your network equipment, and that brings the thing down. But to be brutally honest, that could happen with the best will in the world. Microsoft updates frequently bring networks down or disable things. Manufacturing. We'll come back to the difficult question in a second. Manufacturing is done in a small number of locations on enormous volumes. The semiconductors are produced in really very small number of places. They are vast capital requirements. They make the cost of building a wound look like petty cash. You're really stuck with those. So you're stuck with then thinking, well, what are the applications? And so where you start to create jobs, where you start to generate interesting economic activity is in the applications of the technologies. It's how do you apply that to agriculture? How do you apply that to mining? How do you apply that to e-commerce? How do you apply that to the creative industries? How do you apply that to design? And that's where you start to generate jobs, and that's where you start generate empowerment, because you're not, in a sense, going to overtake Shenzhen in China in the manufacture of equipment for the simple reason that it took them 25 years to get there. It's not a secret that to give you an indication of how seriously the Chinese have been trying that, the current Secretary General of the ITU is Chinese. He has been there for, he's on the second term as Secretary General. He was deputy before that. Before that, he was head of standardization. So these are projects which take 30, 40, 50 years to build a network, to build up the capacity there. So we're looking at how do you use it, and that's where, even if I would be very critical of the 4IR, the theories and the revolutionary part of that, I would say it is a way to think about how do you take 5G technologies and use that in the economy and create jobs, recognizing that it will destroy, not so much it will destroy jobs, it will destroy parts of jobs. Jobs will be automated. The more general question of how you change the structure of the likes of Vodafone or MTN is very hard. It's very hard to see. They say MTN is in Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen. Should they not want the same thing? It becomes much more interesting to think about, Lucy and I have colleagues at a precinct beside the university who are developing a tech hub. How do you develop jobs? How do you develop content in multiple languages? How do you do things with the technology which enable you to build economic activities which create jobs, which create revenues, which fund you? How do you make sure that you're getting reasonable amounts of tax revenues from it? How do you ensure people's cybersecurity? How do you ensure their data protection?